Okay, so what I want to look at today is the book and its reception, because although, of course, we've mostly been talking about James Cook and what he actually did, and how the Indigenous peoples reacted and what difference it made to them, and what his actions showed about European attitudes, preparing colonization, not necessarily decided already the colonization, but that was the normal thing to do. And so when Cook arrives with a couple of goats and leaves a couple of goats on the islands, hoping that they will breed, there's a point at which, I can't remember which island, he says, "Ah, I hope that sometime in the future an Englishman will sit here and look at all the sheep the English have brought to this place." You know, and so, although he never says in so many words, "We are superior," we understand that where he's coming from, that it seems natural to him that bringing the English way of life and the goats. I don't know if you can really populate an island just by taking two goats, actually. I'm not sure if this is actually possible. It might be. But yeah, so we've mostly been looking at his colonial attitudes, some of his scientific attitudes, although I'm going to make some more videos about Cook and science. There's just one more to go up tomorrow about the third expedition, and I'll have finished one, two and three expeditions, and I'll be going on to Cook and science, which is another side of this, because there's a lot of history of science in there. But today, something different, because Cook's book, the journals of James Cook, which we have, or we have an abridged version of, that we've read, had its own life, in a way, that the story is not the same as what happened. And this particular story had a great life, and of course it had a life as part of the way of immortalizing Cook himself and making him into some sort of hero, and in the case of Australia, the national hero. If there's one, that's the guy. In Australia, Cook is bigger than Napoleon in France. It's just because who else are they going to look to? I mentioned that they could have said, "Oh, yes, well, the first governor of Australia," but the first governor of Australia was the head of a prison colony. It's not very romantic and good for a hero. So Captain Cook, who came with his telescope, and did not come, although there was violence and killings, he did not come with an army. And so, perhaps easier to make a hero of. He wasn't like Clive of India, who just, you know, I think I'll have that bit of India. So he could be presented in a different way. And this is the book, then the journal, the three voyages of James Cook around the world. Well, this is not the journal. This is the book. That this is a later edition of the book, but the book was published after there was a book published after Cook's first expedition, and another book published after his second and third ones. But as we will see, they did not resemble the book which we have read. The book which we have read was compiled and published in the 20th century by Beaglehall, who thought it was very important to, and so he was a more of an academic approach. We want the original documents, primary sources, please. You know what university people are like, yeah. Whereas previously there was a less questioning attitude, and the result was, for many many decades, in fact far more than a century, the book that everybody knew, educated people who read, would read The Voyages of James Cook, and it was not written by James Cook. We will see who wrote it in a moment. Perhaps you remember who wrote it. So that's the book. Yeah, this is Hawkesworth's piece. And here this is the same one, is it? Yes, this is the front. This is the front of volume one. In total, there are going to be many, many volumes. In this point, so here are we. I'm trying to read the Latin at the bottom. 1773. Yeah, so this is the first one. 1773. Cook is off again on his second voyage, I think. Or not far off, anyway. And this book then by Hawksworth is in three volumes. The first volume, The Adventures of Commodore Byron, Captain Wallace. You remember he went to Tahiti, first European to go to Tahiti, and Captain Carteret. And the second two volumes will be Captain Cook's first expedition, an account of the voyages undertaken on order of His Present Majesty. Yeah, so you've got to mention the king, and this is important. Yeah, get the words of the king in. And these were drawn up from the journals and from the papers of Joseph Banks by John Hawksworth. Very much illustrated, lots of drawings. It was a tremendously exciting volume for the readership. Now, of course, the readership in 1773 is not millions of people, because most people can't read and write. But it's the educated readership of the Enlightenment. It's the people who are reading Voltaire and reading Locke and reading Hume. This kind of people. However, here we have the word drawn up from the journals by John Hawksworth. Now, that's probably simplifying the question somewhat, because what he decided to do is to write the entire thing in the first person. The first volume would be each section in the first person. I, Captain Wallace, did this. I, Captain Wallace, thought that. And in the second and third volumes, Cook. So if the whole thing is written in the first person. However, a good percentage of what is put in the first person does not come from Cook's journals. He decides to make a more literary effect, and he uses some of the things which Joseph Banks says, but he puts them into the mouth of Captain Cook, because it makes a better story. This was not... generally considered as dishonest. It was considered as making a better story. We have read Captain Cook's journals. They don't make a great story, do they? They're pretty dry and they're interesting historical documents. But you're unlikely to read it if you have children or nephews or nieces or grandchildren. No, say, I'll tell you what I'll do tonight. I'll read Captain Cook's journals to you. That would be probably considered as a form of cruelty. So why John Hawksworth? Well, I'll tell you about that in a moment. But one of the reasons is that they wanted all of the voyages together. Yes, Wallace and Carteret and Cook. By order of His Present Majesty. So this was a little blow for British prestige on a world scale, and as we will see, it is rapidly translated into a few languages. One of the reasons they needed to do this is because that horrible French person, Bougainville, has printed his voyages, and they're selling very well, and they've been translated, and so this is a little bit of colonial competition, if you like, soft power. Yeah, who's got the best story, and so that's what's going on there. Here is one of the manuscripts of the journal. Yeah, so previously this is the book put together by Hawksworth, although, as I says, it says here, drawn up. That's a very, very interesting word, drawn up. It suggests that he didn't make anything up, that he didn't invent anything. But in fact, he did invent things. Yeah. So drawn up. It's a little bit shaky as a thing, as we'll see. Here is one of the manuscripts of Cook's actual journals. There are several copies. I don't know how many copies. In fact, I talked to my friend who is a real proper expert, not like me, and he didn't know how many copies. Quite a lot. They copied them. Perhaps you remember when they got to Batavia, they met first of all a Dutch ship and then the English ship, and they sent a copy of the journal home.
Yep.
This is in case they die and drown before they get home, you know, which was the normal thing to do. Perhaps not quite, but it wasn't unusual. So that's one of the manuscripts. There's one of them is in Australia, and two of them are in London, if I remember correctly. There may be four or altogether, and they're not. Of course, people copy them out. They're not exactly the same, because they're never exactly the same. And also, it was not unusual for Cook to rewrite a passage. And we will come to that in a moment. Here you get a little detail of one of them. You can see, I think that's actually Cook's writing, yes. Anchored in the entrance of Plymouth Sound and anchored in, etc., etc. So, as I was saying, Cook himself didn't get to write the whole thing, and he got friends to, he got other people to do it, but I'll come back to that in a moment. When we look at published accounts of voyages of exploration, then we're used to seeing them as authentic eyewitness reports of what happened during the expedition. I ought to just to say here that most of what I have to say today is based on Jean-Stéphane Massiani, who is the expert who wrote about the Cook's journal as a book, and what happened to it from a writing and literary point of view. So we're used to seeing voyages of explorations. We read it, oh, that must be exactly what happened. And we don't really think of them necessarily as literature, but as documentary, if you like. But in fact, there's actually quite a lot of literary and cultural construction involved. And sometimes that makes a big difference. And this is particularly true with Cook. And it's especially so because, with the exception, especially for the first voyage, but even partly for the rest, for each voyage, Cook didn't get to write the final version. Now, for the second and third expedition, well, of course, after the third expedition, he couldn't write it because he was dead. But after the second expedition, he worked with this gentleman, John Douglas, who was also a bishop. Incidentally, this would not be unusual. Remember, the intellectuals of the time, probably half of them were religious. The church was still extremely important in intellectual life. And so John Douglas worked for the second and third voyage. The third voyage he worked on his own, because Cook was not there. And between the second and third voyage, John Douglas worked with Cook. And Cook was much, much happier with John Douglas because it was a direct exchange, if you like. Whereas for the first voyage, it was John Hawkesworth who wrote it and published it while Cook was at sea. And Cook was rather unhappy with the results, although exactly why there are things we know and there are things we don't know. So we have these two people then, John Douglas and John Hawkesworth, who John Hawkesworth for the first voyage and John Douglas for the second and third voyage, and they had not been there. And so from the point of view of what some readers want, they might say, oh, yes, well, there's a lack of authenticity. These people have not explored any territories. They've not lived on board ship, or they hadn't encountered any of the indigenous populations in questions. And so although they had a large number of illustrations, the illustrations from the ship's artists were even today, I mean, you could look at them for, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of illustrations. And the ship artists, just like if you went on an expedition like that today, you'd come back with hundreds of photos. At the time, they had a very large number of that, which were amazing to the people. They said, oh, wow, this is what a person from Tahiti is like. Look, they've got that's called a tattoo. Have you heard of that? Nobody had heard of it because that's it. The word tattoo came back with Cook. The two words which came back to England with Cook, and both of them got into French with no problem, was one tattoo and the other one taboo.
Really?
Yeah, that's where they come from, which is absolutely fascinating. There may be one or two more words, but those were the big ones. Those were the big ones. So what I'm looking at today, and partly from Massiani and partly from me, is what did they do? How did they manage with these accounts? And in particular today, Hawkesworth and what he did with Cook's Endeavour Journal, his first one. It opens up the question of authorship, or how much Cook is there in Hawkesworth's book. Now, this is not just a technical question to try and understand the ethics of Hawkesworth and so on. It's because, in fact, Hawkesworth's book had 1,000 times more effect on the image of Cook than Cook's Journal, because until the 20th century, almost nobody could read Cook's Journal. So for more than 100 years, for 150 years at least, Hawksworth was Cook in the minds of readers. Yeah, that's what they got. You couldn't choose. You just got Hawksworth. Now Hawksworth today, because it's university lecturers and historians who think about it, and they're all can be a little bit stuffy. He wasn't very faithful to the original, was he? This was not his way of seeing the world. His way of seeing the world: let's have an exciting story which gives a lesson about exploration and enlightenment and the grandeur of the British Empire, and also let's give them something they want to read. Something amazing, something wondrous, that sort of thing. Oh dear. So how much Cook is there in Hawksworth? Well, actually two questions. First of all, what happened to Cook's writing as the years went by? Because you may even have noticed, I did, that the beginning, the first 100 pages, is not written in the same way as the end. Towards the end, the paragraphs are longer, there are more descriptions, it's easier to read, in fact, it's less technical, and so on. So, in some ways, we might think that Cook, who was already, he already has his great role as an imperial scout, his role as a military captain, keeping discipline, making sure the food was okay. And one of the notable things about is about Cook, he was interested in every detail. What food do we have? I'm sure that all captains got to have been like that. Also, we had Cook the scientist, which I will be looking at later on. But he really was a scientist. He wasn't just a ship captain who did a bit of science because his boss told him to. He actually was a scientist. But here we have Cook as a writer. Now, this was not a priority for him, and certainly he may not really have realised it. Certainly he wanted to. He realised that the publishing of the journals, or of a book based on the journals, could make a lot of money. And Hawksworth was paid a fortune. At one point I translated it into modern money, but it was like hundreds of thousands of euros, yeah. It was a really big deal. It wasn't like, historians today. Little complaint there. So how did Cook become a writer? Well, in the first voyage in the Endeavour journal, until he got to Tahiti, the format of the journal is very, very close to the expected format for ship's journals, which is firstly addressed to other sailors, and secondly addressed to the Admiralty, to Cook's boss. So firstly, other sailors wanted to know, and this could be a matter of life or death, what are the prevailing winds? How deep is the water near the shore? Where is there suitable anchorage? What is the seabed like, so we know which anchors to use? Are there any dangerous rocks? And this was really very, very important information, and not very interesting to read if you're not a sailor. But this was a tradition to keep hold of the journals of other sailors to help you around. And so, for example, Cook carried with him on the ship, he had A Voyage Round the World by Captain Samuel Wallace. I'm pretty sure he had that. And it probably wasn't this edition, but he had Wallace's writings. Those were useful to him, first of all, because when he arrived in Tahiti, for example, he found a good bay immediately because Wallace told him where it was. And secondly, when he, sometimes in his own journal, he refers to what Wallace had said. So, oh, I don't really agree with Wallace because... And so on and so forth. So that's first of all that the early part of the Endeavour journal was addressed to other sailors. And secondly, it was addressed to the Admiralty, to show that he had followed their instructions well. We must never forget that James Cook was a military man. Military men are not like me and you, who we will occasionally follow orders, but we don't like it. No. Military men like following orders. That's the way they expect things to go forward. noticed that because he's writing for his boss, he's very careful. And sometimes he rewrites passages for this reason. For example, if there is a mistake, or if there is some unjustified killing of some local people, sometimes he writes it so that he does not name the person who was doing the killing. Because just like, you know, if you write a report to your boss, you say, oh, something got broken. You don't say, Bill Smith broke it, because you don't do that. You know, you have a certain amount of loyalty. The other thing about the writing for the Admiralty is, naturally enough, James Cook writes the descriptions of scenes of conflicts in a way that show that he was right. Of course, that's what he's going to do. And I think that's important that... once we get away from the hagiography, the entire journal must be taken with a pinch of salt, in the sense that we sometimes have alternative versions, but they're always from the other Europeans on the ship. Because, of course, the indigenous culture not having writing, there's very little reply made. So, you know, we always have to take them. You know, a lot of the things he says are true. But we can't assume that it's all true, because, you know, that wouldn't be possible. At the same time, we'll notice in the style, when you're writing for your boss, then there's very little speculation and there's very little emotion. In any case, he was not a literary man. He wasn't interested. That wasn't his aim. Now, I already mentioned briefly in one of the videos the contrast with the fabulous Journal of Bougainville. Bougainville was an intellectual, completely different. And he did not hesitate to give his opinion about world politics. Oh, this is what the Portuguese Empire is doing. This is what the Spanish Empire is doing. It's much more intelligent. Let me explain why. For example, Bougainville arrived in South America at a time when the Spanish Empire was deciding to expel the Jesuit priests. The Jesuits formed their own communities and could be very powerful. Powerful enough to lead major armed rebellions against the Spanish crown. Yeah. I mean, when we think Jesuit priests, we think, oh yeah, they pray all day. No. The Jesuits, they were a serious force, yeah. And there were whole sections of, there were whole towns in South America controlled by the Jesuits. And they sometimes fought battles against the Spanish crown. You know, it was really serious stuff. And at one point, the Spanish Empire decides, let's expel all the Jesuits around the world from the crown territories. And secret instructions, it must happen everywhere on the same day. And Bougainville explains this, and he also gives his opinion on whether it's a good idea or not. When Cook never does this. Cook never goes into geopolitics. It's not his thing. He's not an intellectual. When Cook speaks of future imperial territories in the parts of the world he is exploring, he speaks in a very general way. As, for example, when he says, it will be wonderful when the English have sheep and crops thriving here. He does not go into geopolitics. He stays with a loyalist and uncomplicated view of the British Empire. The British Empire for Cook is not a problem. It's just the way things are, in the way that, you know, you would expect. There's another journal which I think it would be important to contrast with is the Journal of Joseph Banks. Now, this is another fabulous book, and again, it was only published in the 20th century by Beagle Hall as well. He was very busy, Beagle Hall, preparing all these journals. And Joseph Banks was completely different sort of text. Joseph Banks was an educated rich man, not like Cook. Banks quoted Virgil's Aeneid. Says, oh, you know, let us compare what we are doing with what Virgil, the great heroes of Virgil's Aeneid and Homer's Iliad did, you know. This reminds me of when Laocoon, I can't remember what Laocoon did. I get a feeling that he ended he ended in quite a bad way, but there you go. And so Cook never does this. There are no classical references in Cook's journal. He doesn't do that. And when he does put in cultural references, they are sometimes from popular culture. For example, at one point he compares a local show, a local spectacle which has been put on, and he compares it with Punch and Judy, which is 18th century from the poor part of town, the puppet show of Punch and Judy, which is still, you can still see today, although it's recently been considered to be, let's say, not entirely feminist. It's all about how important it is to beat your wife with a big stick. So you know, it's not quite in the. I hope it's not quite as fashionable in its ideas today. And so Cook compares to this, you know. So you can see he's not from the same culture. He's not been to. Yeah, he's not. He's not Joseph Banks, and never will be. However, little by little, his journal changes. The Journal of Cook changes in style. And in particular, it changes for the first time, perhaps, after he arrives in Tahiti, where he feels a need to try to describe local society. Now, of course, describing local mountains or local seas or local rivers is easy if you're a sailor. But describing local society and ceremonies and religious places is extremely difficult when you don't speak the language. So you're kind of guessing the meaning. And indeed, there's a quotation from Boswell. Boswell was an 18th century intellectual, friend of Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson, who wrote the first major dictionary of the English language. And Samuel Boswell said, "I said I was certain that a great part of what we are told by the travellers to the South Sea must be conjecture, because they had not enough of the language of those countries to understand so much as they have related. Everything intellectual, everything abstract, politics, morals and religion, must be darkly guessed." Yeah. And so Boswell is underlining that these first travellers are not going to give you a good explanation of how the local society works, because without the language they're just, oh yeah, he looks like a priest, he must be a priest. Is she the queen? Or was she's got something on her head, she must be the queen. It's a bit like Britain today, really. There you go. So Cook was beginning, nevertheless, to get back to the story, Cook was beginning to become a writer. And Jean-Stéphane Messiani says that no doubt he would be very much helped by the conversations with Banks. Remember that when you're at sea in the Endeavour, and I think I told you I went to the Replica, it is extremely small. If you can imagine the sort of studio that students live in Paris, well, it's like you had, even the officers, it's like you had four people or five people living in that small space. For the crew, it's even more crowded. But even those who had a lot of space, Banks had the biggest cabin. It was half the size of my bedroom. It was not five star stuff, you know. If you go on a cruise today, you would expect better. So we can imagine that there would be permanent dialogue. And indeed, interestingly enough, Banks and Cook seem to have become quite good friends. And if I remember correctly, Joseph Banks looked after Cook's widow later on, which was important because, of course, when you're a widow, you're quite a vulnerable person in 18th century Britain. And they became quite good friends, which is rather unusual because Banks was very young. He was in his early 20s when he went on this voyage. Cook was 39 or something around those around that, and he was from a poor background, a military man. He'd worked himself up. Banks was a bit of a party guy, When they went to... it seems fairly clear from all the different accounts that when they got to Tahiti, Cook described that many of the men were consorting with local ladies, let's say. Banks wasn't writing about it. He was probably seeing how many girls he could sleep with in the same evening. You know, that was more Banks. It was a more different style of thing. Okay, I just need to let my cat out. So, as the journal goes on, it changed. Now, as we know, after the first voyage, Hawkesworth was given the job of turning the journal into a publishable account. And it's in the second voyage when Cook arrives in Cape Town in South Africa that he comes across, that he sees a copy of this book, and he is very unhappy with it. Now, the different sources suggest that one of the reasons he was unhappy is that some of the things he had not said appeared in the book. You know, there was a whole load of things he never said which were in the book. And it seems that one of the things that most annoyed him was the descriptions of the inhabitants of St. Helena. Because in the book, in Hawkesworth's book, Cook is very negative about these people and says that they mistreat their slaves and that there's no technology, it's a really backward place. Now, we don't know what it is about this which annoyed him more than the rest. It may be that he did not want to have political opinions put into his mouth. It may be a political thing. It may not. I've never found a really very clear indications on this. And in any case, this was one of the reasons he decided that he himself was going to control the publication of the journals of the second voyage, that he wasn't going to accept. Now, after the first voyage, it's not really clear to me that he had a choice. I think the Admiralty said, thank you very much for your journals. We will find somebody to publish them. This is none of your business. However, little by little, Cook was becoming a more important person. We saw he was allowed two ships for the second voyage, which is much safer. You'd stand a much more chance of coming home. And so he appeared to feel that he could control the publication of the journals of the second voyage, or a book based on the publication of the book based on the journals of the second voyage. Also, he was not indifferent to the money. He knew that Hawkesworth had been paid a lot of money, and perhaps he felt, hey, I took all the risk, and Hawkesworth made all the money. But in any case, he did actually write in a letter, and we have some of his letters to friends. He actually wrote in a letter, oh, yes, I'm pleased to say that I will be making the money from the publication of the journals of the second voyage. Yes, and since money had some importance for him. Like I say, we have some of his letters. Unfortunately, his widow, Elizabeth Cook, burnt all the letters he sent to her shortly before her death, apparently. This was a big deal. And so historians don't like Elizabeth Cook because she did that. So once he has in mind then this idea that he's going to be the person who publishes it, his journal itself changes in style. And as we get into the second voyage, if you like, we see much less technical information, just the minimum, because, you know, the reader is not going to really take that on. We see a change in the organisation of the entries, that instead of doing like sailors do and counting the day as starting at midday and finishing at midday, strange way of seeing the world, if you like. He used the civilian, what we consider normal, and he made his days start at midnight and finish at midnight. Whereas in the first voyage, when you read it, it says, you know, this is what we did in the afternoon, and then this is what we did in the morning. You know, and then it says May the 9th. This is what we did in the afternoon, and then this is what we did in the morning. May the 10th. And you skip, it's always starts with the afternoon, which is absolutely true. That this is a ship time, as they say. So those are two of the changes, less technical information and the use of civilian time instead of ship time. But also we see some literary devices which are very clear signs of how he sees his writing. And I recommend you go and look for a couple of examples to make sure you have a couple of examples. What he does is he appeals to the reader. Every now and then he says, "I'm sure the reader will agree with me when I said I was obliged to do this because." He doesn't do this in the first voyage because he doesn't have a reader in mind. Well, he just has professional readers in mind, professional sailors. And also he uses other kind of literary devices. As you know, I cannot describe this because I am a simple man and I have had little education. These are very classic literary devices, yeah? And so he asks the reader to understand him, or he tries to reassure the reader, and so on. We're also told, and in particular by another intellectual called Carol Percy, who worked on this, which is I think it's fascinating, and she looked at the difference in style in the second journal on, and she tried to measure a number of things. She actually went and looked for the words. For example, as you know, these are examples. I'll read it to you if you can't see it. Don't worry. I know what you mean. I can see it with my glasses on. She looked at the past tense forms of to blow, to draw, to know, and to throw. Now, as you know, and all English students know, the past tenses blew, drew, knew, and threw. However, less educated people at the time often wrote blowed, drawed, knowed, and throwed. And here you can see in this little table which one did he use in the first voyage journals and which one did he use in the second and third voyage. And we can see that his language becomes much more, if you like, intellectual, much more officially correct. Yeah? So in the first voyage, if you just take the one word to blow, of course you use the word a lot if you're a sailor, because things are blowing all the time. In the first voyage journal, he used the word, the past tense blew, 3 times. And the past tense blowed 17 times. So his favourite was blowed, the uneducated version, if you like. Whereas in the third voyage, he never used the word blowed. And he used the word blew 53 times. It was windier in the north, obviously. So this is just a couple of that's just one example. But in fact, in her article, she looks at 10 or 15 different examples of forms which are usually used by educated people, and forms which are usually used by uneducated people. And I think that's really good work. Yeah, I would never have thought of that myself. Here's just one more example here. Not an example, just one more piece of information. We have a little bit of information about what happened to the second journal. Well, Cook worked carefully with Dr. Douglas. I mentioned Dr. Douglas, the bishop. We have the letters which Douglas wrote to Cook. And Cook, it says here, Cook copied out his journal in sections and sent them to Douglas to, and I quote, "make such alterations as you see necessary." And in a later letter to Douglas, Cook wrote, "I have not had time to look over the corrections, but I have not the least doubt but that they were necessary." So we're in a situation where it's very, very clear to Cook, you know, what I need to do here. I want it to be official and educated language, and I'm doing my best, and so I'm making an effort with blow and blowed and blew. But also, I'm happy to have a bishop, usually bishops. If you need a book correcting, ask a bishop. They're really good at this. I really recommend it. That's what you need to do. And so that's another sign of the way that Cook was looking differently at his writing. And indeed, in the second and third voyage, he sometimes speaks of himself as a writer. And interestingly enough, again, rhetorical device, he often says, "I am a plain speaking sailor. I'm not a literary man. I'm only a sailor. But I was really there. This is my authentic experience," which is the language of the rhetoric of authenticity, which is always an important thing. I wonder if I think I should be okay there. I have two keyboards and two mice. Okay, because I have the ATEX above here. Right, so that's basically what happened there. And so let's have a look then back, to go back a bit. So that was the first part, what happened to Cook's writing, and how he saw himself differently, and he saw his writing differently, and so this affected the journal. But now, if we go back or forward or somewhere to what happened to the first journal, once he gave it to the Admiralty, the Admiralty said, we want John Hawkesworth. We want John Hawkesworth to write it. Well, John Hawkesworth was already an experienced author, journalist and editor. Before he published Cook's Voyages, his most famous work had been Jonathan Swift's Complete Works. He had been the editor who presented Jonathan Swift's Complete Works, and as you know, the most famous of Jonathan Swift's books. Can you help me here? Vous en avez entendu parler quand même, c'est les voyages de Gulliver.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I thought that was a tricky question.
I don't do... I don't do trick questions.
And it's in option A, literature, I've heard about it.
Okay, yeah.
Of course it's famous.
Yeah, and it's probably more famous for the films than the books, but there you go. Some very good films of Gulliver's Travels. So Gulliver's Travels, well, interestingly enough, now Gulliver's Travels is the story of an imaginary voyage. It resembles in some ways Voltaire's Candide.
Oui.
Because he goes to different countries and looks at different imaginary societies and draws conclusions about ethics and philosophy and so on. I mean, I love Candide, where you see seulement le docteur Pangloss n'avait pas été pendu. It's fabulous. And Gulliver finds, for example, one society where they go to war for ridiculous reasons. And so on and so forth. But there's something very, very interesting here, because we think of Cook, well, it depends. I mean, modern people think of Cook as either a hero or a villain or a historical character who really made a difference to history. But look at the Admiralty itself, you know. Who do we want to write up Cook's journal so lots of people read them? Oh, let's get that guy. He's already famous for writing up voyages. He did Gulliver's Travels. He edited that. So, I mean, in a way, it's kind of putting it in the same category. Away, I mean, and certainly today, you know, if you were the first person to go to Mars and you'd kept a journal, would you ask a famous science fiction writer to publish it? You might not want to. You might think, oh, it's a bit confusing, you know, fiction. But that was part of it. In any case, they called on Hawkesworth because he was very good. Hawkesworth also wrote a biography of Swift, and Dr. Johnson, who was, you know, I mean, Dr. Johnson was a big guy. He first ever dictionary, you know, he was pretty good. He said Hawkesworth is, I quote, "a man capable of dignifying his narration with so much elegance of language and force of sentiment." Hawkesworth was a very established writer with a good reputation. He had just translated a French book, Télémaque, which I don't know. It's by Fénelon. That's all I know about it. And Télémaque is a Greek story, but obviously in this version by a French writer. So he was well known in London's literary and cultural circles. And so Lord Sandwich, who, if I remember correctly, was the head of the Admiralty, in September 1771, gave him Cook's journals, and almost 2 years later, in June 1773, that first book which I showed to you was published, an account of the voyages undertaken by the order of His Present Majesty for making discoveries in the Southern Hemisphere. Published in three volumes, the first volume dedicated to the voyages of Byron, Wallace and Carteret, and volumes 2 and 3 contained the relation of Cook's Endeavour voyage. It was an immediate success. The 2,000 copies of the first edition sold out quickly. Now, of course, we remember that in the 18th century, a bestseller was many thousands, not many millions, because not enough people could read. Also, books were very expensive. The actual physical object was very expensive. A second and a third edition soon appeared, followed quickly by translations into German, French, and later Italian. So it was a great success. Hawkesworth, who already was recognised as a writer, suddenly became very famous. However, he also received strong criticism. Not by Cook. Frankly, nobody really cared what Cook thought. You know, Hawkesworth was a great writer. Cook was a very competent imperial hero, but, you know, he was not an intellectual. Nobody's going to listen to his opinion about this. And indeed, a Hawkesworth biographer, Abbott, talks about the Great Voyage Controversy of 1773. So the criticism of Hawkesworth about this book. Now, if we criticise Hawkesworth's book today, we're talking about accuracy and putting words into Cook's mouth that he didn't really say. And these criticisms may be considered acceptable, or that they remind me somewhat of what happens today when people make a historical film. And people criticise them for making a historical film. So that didn't happen exactly like that. But of course, if you're trying to tell somebody's life in a 2-hour film, you are obliged to simplify. It can't be done, yeah? And so, I think probably Hawkesworth is defensible in some ways, because he needed to make it something people wanted to read. But that was not the case. Of the criticisms we received were not mostly about that at all. Now, most of this criticism appeared as either in people's journals or also anonymous letters published in newspapers. Now, some people questioned the literary value of the work, but many others considered it to be scandalous, because the passages about the willingness of Tahitian women to sleep with anybody, or the passages, I don't know if you remember, there's a passage where they watch a local adult having sex with a very young girl of 10 or 12 years old, and that they watch it in public, you know. This is considered to be very, very shocking. And this is what is considered by the audience as dissolute morals. People were not saying, yes, their society is completely different, so of course their morals are different too. That was not the attitude of people that said, they don't have any morals. I mean, because, you know. However, the more serious criticisms were also what Hawkesworth said about some of the main events. He didn't talk about God enough. For example, for the likings of his critics, yeah. So, for example, when the Endeavour was crashed onto the coral reef, and where they very nearly all died, the Hawkesworth book, just like Cook's journal, talk essentially about the technical, clever things they did to save them. And it was pretty clever. They took one of the sails and they went under the boat and they put a sail on the hole as a bandage. It's pretty clever. I would have just drowned, you know. So it's pretty clever stuff. But they were supposed to, or the criticisms would have been happier if they had attributed the Endeavour's escape on the Australian coast to the workings of divine providence. Yeah. Which also would have been very useful for the colonial vision, because, of course, it's not. It's tremendously useful to consider that God is on our side. So it's, you know, I mean, you know, who wouldn't want, you know? It's like when you play football in school. God would be the first person to be chosen to be on your side. I think, you know, always useful. There are also a few people who criticised Hawksworth because. For they did criticise him for inauthenticity. You've never been to sea. What are you talking about? And indeed, one of Cook's later colleagues on the Resolution said that Hawksworth's book was universally censured, universally criticised. As you say, and I said, Cook was unhappy. In fact, Cook said, in many particulars, I have been misrepresented. Indeed, it's even said, although this is something which is difficult to prove, that Hawksworth took these criticisms very personally and that it contributed to his illness and death only 6 months after the publication. Now, this is something which has been said and repeated, but it seems to me that it would be rather difficult to prove, so I really would put that in inverted commas, or as you say in French, au conditionnel. So let's go. So poor old Hawksworth didn't enjoy his fame for very long. Although, same, you know, people often died quite young, you know, so there's nothing, it was not quite so surprising. So let's have a look then at Hawksworth. What did Hawksworth do to the journal? How did it change it? Well, each of the books, because there were two volumes, but this was divided into, I think, three books. And each book more or less corresponds to one of the great steps on the voyage, Tahiti, New Zealand and New Holland. And most of the text of Hawksworth talks about things which happened on land. And the sections of Cook's journal which happen at sea are much reduced. And indeed, we already have that in our version, because the Penguin version, which we have read, takes away a lot of the things that happen at sea, because then they're not as historically important. So it's very much a concentration on things which happened at sea, meetings, skirmishes, descriptions of places and people, people being killed, reflections on customs or rituals, and so on. And he takes away, of course, most of the technical data. He also makes Cook's sentences much longer. Cook's sentences are very telegraphic, very utilitarian, especially as I was saying in the first voyage. This is the first voyage, and he makes them into much more readable sentences. He also changes the style. The spelling is harmonized. So if he spells somebody's name in one way, he spells it in the same way all the way through. You probably didn't notice, and I didn't notice, but if they talk about the Lady Chief of Tahiti, sometimes called the Queen of Tahiti, in Cook's journal, this is sometimes spelt Purea, sometimes Obera, sometimes Obaria, and sometimes Obareya. Now, four different ways of spelling the same person's name in Cook's journal. Well, that's not. Obviously, if you're going to publish a book, you don't do that. And so he chooses one of them, Obadiah. And Hawksworth's book concentrates on the emotional potential of the text, as if it was literature. He focuses on human relations. And so many passages of Cook's original journal are rewritten so as to create more emotion that you didn't have. So, for example, there's a scene in which two Tahitian chiefs, Tuburai and Tutaha, are reunited after one of them has been held prisoner by the British. Just one example, because I can't give you many examples, just one example. This is what Cook writes in his journal. The scene between Tubaratamita and Tutaha when the former came into the fort and found the latter in custody was really moving. They wept over each other for some time. As for Tutaha, he was so far prepossessed with the thought that he was to be killed that he could not be made sensible to the contrary till he was carried out of the fort to the people, many of whom expressed their joy by embracing him. Now, even in Cook's style, there's quite a lot of representation of emotion. And this, for the people reading this, well, not reading this, but reading the even more emotional one of, this is something would be absolutely fascinating because, you know, they really would, the Tahitians would be so much more foreign than they are to us today. So they really would be saying, so they do have emotions. Yeah, because they would really be seeing them as like a different species, you know, the other thing would be very strong. So Cook's description is relatively short, factual and neutral. The emotion is present but not overwhelming. So let's see what Hawkesworth does with the same section. About 8 o'clock, Mr. Banks with Tubarai Tamaidi got back to the fort. When, to his great surprise, he found Tutaha in custody, and many of the natives in the utmost terror and distress crowding about the gates. He went hastily in. Some of the Indians were suffered to follow him, and the scene was extremely affecting. Tubaraya Tamaide, pressing forward, ran up to Tutaha, and catching him in his arms, they both burst into tears and wept over each other without being able to speak. The other Indians were also in tears for their chief, both he and they being strongly possessed with the notion that he was to be put to death. So I'm only giving you one example, and Mr. Masiani gives three, but there are many, many, many. Of course, you can see that. Now, this is my personal opinion is, as you say in French, c'est de bonne guerre. He's trying to write a book which will sell, and which will make people marvel, and which will make the French think, oh, perhaps the best explorers is not Bougainville, but Cook. No, Bougainville's all right. He's a bit of an intellect. You know, all this story about geopolitics, who cares? I want to see, you know, some sex and drugs and rock and roll. Mutatis mutandis. Hawkesworth is also careful not to offend readers' sensitivity. And so sometimes he will omit some details. For example, when Hawkesworth describes the tomb of a Tahitian killed by the British, he omits one sentence of Cook's journal. It certainly was no agreeable place, for it stunk intolerably. That's what Cook said. And Joseph Banks, in Joseph Banks' journal, wrote, I lifted up the cloth and saw part of the body already dropping to pieces with putrefaction about him, and indeed with all parts of his place were abundance of maggots and a species of beetle very common here. That's Joseph Banks, which c'est un peu plus gore. And Hawkesworth thought, oh, that there are no maggots, there are no beetles, there's no smell. Yeah, so this is perhaps unsurprising, yeah, that he's going to make it a cleaner, the exploration adventure is going to be cleaner. Hawkesworth also follows other rules of literature. So he introduces classical references. He compares the Maori women to the goddess Diana. And he compares Tahitian women to the goddess Venus. And he compares the musicians in the Society Islands and the bards of ancient Greece. Of course, this is not Cook. Cook would never do this. Cook hasn't read any of these books, any of these myths and so on. So, but remember that Hawkesworth's book is written in the first person. I, James Cook, did this. I, James Cook, said this. And so suddenly we have a different Cook. The narrator Cook in Hawkesworth is not the same as the narrator Cook in the journals. And indeed, the narrator Cook in the third journal is not the same as the narrator Cook in the first journal. Because this is, as you know, because you study literature too, we consider that the writer creates a narrator who is not the same as the writer. So in Hawkesworth's book, Cook becomes a cultivated man of letters. who is able to reflect upon serious subjects such as religion or death or the nature of fire. In Hawksworth's book, Cook compares the funeral rites in Tahiti with those described by the Greek and Roman classic authors. In Hawksworth's book, Cook is also a man who can speak in a very precise way of the plants and animals, using the Latin names like an intellectual would at the time. Naturally enough, Cook in Hawksworth is even more of a hero than Cook in Cook. Hawksworth offers an idealised portrait of a firm, self-confident and magnanimous commander. I haven't read the whole of Hawksworth, but I can imagine that there are no detailed descriptions of soldiers being flogged, of sailors being flogged. In Hawksworth, everything Cook says, does, is justified. He has such a noble character that he is quite different from ordinary human beings. And there's a couple of examples where some of the local people are shot dead in Hawksworth, Cook disapproves and says, you know, we must treat them better than this. You know, it's all, in fact, in this particular incident that mentioned here, April the 15th, 1769, Cook relates the story, but does not show any emotion and does not condemn the action. In this case, a local person steals something and is killed for stealing. However, in Hawksworth's version, the soldier who shot the local person is denounced. So you can see what's going on here. I have here a little section of Hawksworth, just to give an example of something slightly different. This is after one of the locals has been killed. I am conscious that the feeling of every reader of humanity... Yeah. I love you, readers. You're so nice. Every reader of humanity will censure me for having fired upon these unhappy people. And it is impossible that upon a calm review I should approve it myself. Hawksworth says that Cook regrets it. He's just inventing this. They certainly did not deserve death for not choosing to confide in my promises or not consenting to come on board my boat, even if they had apprehended no danger. But the nature of my service required me to obtain a knowledge of their country, which I could no otherwise effect than by forcing my way into it in a hostile manner, or gaining admission through the confidence and goodwill of the people. There's a fascinating passage here where he says, it's terrible to kill people, and you agree with me, but I had my orders. What can you do? I had my orders. Now, of course, neither Cook nor Hawksworth could imagine that the orders of the British Empire were not such a good thing. That was impossible for them to imagine, of course. That's how it works. One final example in describing the so-called Queen of Tahiti, Purea or Obalea, as you wish, in April 1769. Now, she visited the Endeavour. This was something which interested very much readers at the time, because, of course, they expected the leaders of the local peoples to be all men. But they weren't, and so, you know, it was all very fascinating for them. And she visited the Endeavour in April 1769. And in his journal, Cook had... I'm quoting Masiani here. In his journal, Cook has very few words to describe her. He simply noted that this woman is about 40 years of age, and like most of the other women, very masculine. Of course, from the point of view of 18th century Britain. Banks gave a more elaborate description. To Banks, she appeared to be about 40, tall and very lusty. Je crois que lusty ça veut dire solide. sur les membres bâtis. Je ne suis pas absolument sûr. J'ai l'impression quand même. Sorry?
I think maybe. Yeah. I was thinking about lust, you know, so...
Yeah, that's not my impression. It's a word I would have to check, but my impression is that lusty is, like, solid and full of things. Mm. Do check it. It's not German lustig, which means funny.
I'm checking.
Please do.
The skin
do.
White and, you know, so we never know, eh?
You never know. No, I
vigoureux,
yeah.
Strong, robust.
Hey, my English...
You're right, as usual.
My English is very good, isn't it?
Amazing.
Perhaps I could get a job. Okay, her skin white and her eyes full of meaning. Full of meaning, interesting idea. She might have been handsome when young, but now few or no traces of it were left. Tell me about it. Okay. Well. And this is Hawksworth. Yeah, so we had Cook and Banks, and here's Hawksworth. She seemed to be about 40 years of age and was not only tall, but of large make. Her skin was white, and there was an uncommon intelligence and sensibility in her eyes. She appeared to have been handsome when she was young, but at this time little more than memorials of her beauty were left. So, you know, he's a better writer than Cork, of course, yeah?
Definitely.
And so he's got it there. So, that's... In conclusions then, the most important thing about this is that Hawksworth Book was Cook for 150 years. Yeah, and remember that it had additional legitimacy, because what did you find in the book? The illustrations drawn by the people who were on Cook's ship. And because the illustrations were completely genuine and completely authentic, then, of course, how could the reader not imagine that the text also? And so it was just taken completely, and that is what Beaglehole, put it, that for 200 years, in fact, yeah, for 200 years until Cook's journals were made available to the public, Beaglehole says, so far as the first voyage was concerned, Hawksworth was Cook.